Okay, and we've been studying for some time now various aspects of the Abrahamic covenant. It's kind of a pivotal milestone in our study here in the book of Genesis. We actually were introduced to that back in chapter 12. And as we've worked our way on down through the succeeding chapters now, we've seen the various aspects of that covenant then kind of be worked out and come into play and so on. You remember the three main provisions of the Abrahamic covenant? A land, seed, and blessing. And the land was kind of defined for us fairly early on, and we looked at some maps of that, and it's essentially the nation Israel. Some debate and some argument about the exact boundaries, but that's what it was mainly. The blessing will come later in the person of Jesus Christ. We'll see that later on in Scripture. And the seed part is what we've been seeing most recently. We've seen how the nation itself actually began to be developed. Initially, God's dealings was primarily with individuals. Abraham's one son, Isaac, that is the son that he manifested the covenant through. Abraham had more than one son. And then Isaac's son, Jacob. And that's where we started to see then the actual growth of the nation take place, was during the generation of Jacob. And you remember where that happened? That took place in Israel, right? Israel was born in Israel? Not so. This is page 37 of your handout. Well, you can't see it there. But Israel was actually born, the nation Israel was born up here in Mesopotamia, in Haran in particular. Remember, Jacob had to go up there to run from his brother Esau. Esau was wanting to take his scalp for ripping him off a couple of times. And so he comes from down here and goes up there and stayed for about 20 years. And it was while he was up there that the nation Israel was actually born and started to grow into multiple people. And you remember how many sons and daughters he had while he was up there? Well, ultimately, it's going to be 12 sons. Now, they weren't quite all done up there. This is page 38 in your handout, too, by the way. But see this line right across here, this generation here? That's the origin of Israel's nation. There's the 12 sons, well, 11 of them here. And then Benjamin will come along later. He's not here just yet, but he will come along. So that right across here, well, I think the batteries in this thing are done. I can barely see that myself. At any rate, right across there, you see his 12 sons. Also had a daughter. She didn't get much press, as we've noted, but she is recorded in Scripture anyway. So the nation was actually born up in Haran in the form of these 12 sons, ultimately 12, 11 up there and Benjamin on the way back. And we've been seeing then sort of the growth and development of them as they will be the basis then for the nation Israel. So a period of about 20 years, the sons were born over about 14 or less of those 20 years. And then he stayed up there another six, remember, to try to make some money. And he did. But the nation began up there over a period of about 14 years during the lifetime of Jacob. Now, as we want to continue on here this morning, we'll see more of this family's development and growth take place. But first of all, there is the record of the descendants of Esau here in chapter 36. Esau, remember, was the progenitor of the nation of Edom. The Edomites, which are, let's see, this map, I'll probably show that okay. They're back over here. See them down here? Down here in the bottom right corner of this map, on the east side of the Jordan and the Dead Sea, and then down south, down and through there. He would be the progenitor of those peoples. And if you want a little background on them, look at the Old Testament prophet Obadiah. Obadiah is the shortest book in the Bible, but it's all about Edom. Now, this is not the Obadiah that Elijah encountered during his lifetime. That's a different Obadiah. This guy is the writing prophet Obadiah. You can go look there if you want to get a little bit of the background of the nation Edom. But we'll see a little bit of that here this morning ourselves. So chapter 36 is the book of Genesis. These are the records of the generations of Esau. That is Edom. So Edom was the land of Esau's descendants. Now, there was quite a notorious biblical character that was an Edomite. Can you think of who that might be?
King Herod.
Yeah, Herod the not-so-great. Yeah, he was an Edomite. He was from there. He was probably the most infamous Edomite that we have in Scripture anywhere. And in verses 1 through 3, we see Esau's three wives, Ada, Oholibamah, and Basemath. Those are the three. He actually had three wives. And in verses 4 and 5, you can see the names of his sons there. And in verses 6 through 8, you can see sort of an indication of the wealth that Esau had accumulated and had to basically move away from, living down in the same region as his father and Jacob, because they had so much stuff that they couldn't all live together. So he went to another land away from his brother Jacob. And it's kind of interesting that his physical separation here is kind of emblematic of his spiritual separation as well. Esau moved away from the promised land over there toward Edom and lived. And Esau never had any spiritual insight in the family at all, did he? So his physical movement is kind of picturesque of his spiritual movement as well. He never showed any real spiritual insight either. And so separating himself from God's people and from God's place of promise, the Holy Land, is kind of symptomatic of his spiritual condition as well. Now, there's not too much else in this list of people that I know to tell you about. Verse 12 is a little bit of an exception to that. You see in verse 12, they mention of Amalek, one of Esau's descendants. Remember when Israel came out of the promise, out of Egypt, and was heading over toward the promised land, they encountered these Amalekites. And there was a battle that took place, and this is the one where when Moses could hold his arms out like this, the Israelites were winning. But he couldn't hold them there all the time because it just got too heavy. And so Joshua and Nun sat him on a rock and they held his arms up. And as they held his arms up, then Israel defeated these Amalekites. That's in Exodus chapter 17, by the way, if you want to review that for any reason. But the Amalekites, the descendants of Esau, were a problem to Israel. They were Israel's enemy. And not only that, later on when Saul was king, the battle with the Amalekites was where he basically forfeited his right to the kingship there in Israel. Remember, Samuel met him and said, "You wipe out all these guys, everybody." And Saul didn't do that. He left the king, Agag, I think was his name, alive. And because of that act of disobedience, he was essentially stripped of his kingship in Israel. That's 1 Samuel 15 is where that record takes place. So there's a little bit of history there on the part of the Amalekites. And they were a problem for Israel. Fought them and battled them for many years. They weren't wiped out until it was after Solomon. It was downstream from Solomon. I forget the king, one of the different kings, finally finished these guys off, but it was a long time after this. This is about 1700 BC, and that would be about 900. So it was about 800 years these guys hung around before they were actually wiped out. But at any rate, they're in that descendancy there. And I don't see a whole lot else to mention to you. Verse 20, the sons of Seir, or the Horite, are included in this delineation here, and apparently this guy Seir was there first, and Esau moved into that area, and then Esau and his descendants intermarried with Seir and his descendants, and that's where the Edomites came from. So he's mentioned in verse 20, and a bunch of his guys as well. And so I guess people that study these sort of things, these genealogies and this sort of stuff, they may be interested in this, but I don't know anything else to really mention to you about these. So chapter 36 sort of wraps up Esau's descendancy. And he populated along with the descendants of this guy Seir then the territory of Edom, which was southeast of Israel, and were a problem to Israel for many years to come. Any questions or anything about any of that? I don't know much about it. I don't know if I could even answer a decent question about Esau's descendants, but there they are for whatever good that is. All right, now in chapter 37, things kind of get back to the theme of the developing line of the nation itself. I've mentioned to you before that there's a number of different stories in the Old Testament that illustrate the principle of divine providence, the control of the affairs of men by God, his managing the details of people's lives to control and to accomplish what he wants to. This story in chapter 37 is another one of those that's really quite clear and very good picture of that principle. Now, if you question that principle, go read Daniel chapter 4 again, because it's made very, very clear there that God controls the affairs of men. And Nebuchadnezzar got to be a cow for 7 years until he learned that. He was a slow learner, and so he grazed for 7 years. But that chapter in the book of Daniel, which is, of course, after this by a lot, makes it very clear that God is indeed in control of the affairs of men. And he raises men up and lowers men down, however he so chooses, and puts them in whatever roles he wants to. Very clear in Daniel chapter 4. So that principle there is illustrated here as well in this particular incident involving Joseph. So let's take a look at this and see what God is doing here to control the affairs of men. Chapter 37, verse 1. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. That was down south there. Remember that? He was living down here in Hebron area. You don't have this map in your deal, so you have to look at it up here. So kind of in southern Israel is where Isaac hung up, and Jacob finally got moved down there to him, although kind of reluctantly and slowly. And these are the records of the generation of Jacob. So this will kind of conclude Jacob's storyline here in Scripture. Joseph is now the focus of the story. When he was 17 years of age, he was pastoring the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now, Joseph, when the storyline picks up here now, is a 17-year-old. So we got to cut him a little bit of slack in the first place, don't we? I mean, he's a teenager. He's capable of anything, as all teenagers are. And he's out shepherding the flock with certain of his brothers, the two maids' brothers, Bilhah and Zilpah's sons, I beg your pardon, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. So he's out shepherding with that foursome, okay? Now, we've seen already in this family picture some rather extreme bias on the part of Jacob for certain of his sons at the expense of certain other of his sons. Remember when he lined them up to meet Esau? Who got put out front, so they're going to get ran over first? These guys, these four brothers. The sons of the handmaids were the least loved and least cared for by Jacob. And they know it. He's made it too obvious to them. This daddy always loved me best stuff, that doesn't work well, guys. And they know that someone else is the object of dear old dad's affection, and it ain't them. They know it's Joseph. So here's Joseph up there with those guys, shepherding the flock somewhere. And he comes back and dumps this bad report on them. He comes back to his father and basically says, these guys stink as shepherds. They're not good shepherds. They're not reliable. They're not the kind of guys you want to send your resources off with, because they do a crummy job of shepherding. Now, this is a 17-year-old reporting back to dear old dad. One could hope that maybe he would have had a little more tact, although at 17, you can't hope for much. And so maybe he could have said something like, well, Dad, these guys, they try, they work hard, they try, but they're not really the most skillful shepherds we got in the family here. And kind of moderated this report a little bit to where it was a little more palatable for the boys, the four brothers, to accept. But that doesn't appear to be the case. It appears that he came back and basically said, these guys are worthless. So the disharmony that we already see implanted into this family is simply exacerbated by Joseph and his lack of tact. They don't like him already. He's about as close to a spoiled brat as we're going to find in Scripture. He's a child of privilege, the favorite of the 11 brothers, and he reports back badly on them. Is that going to work out well, you think? Is that going to endear him to the brothers very, very well? And Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, and they know that, unfortunately, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. Now, if things ain't bad enough, Jacob wraps his son in a neon sign that flashes on and off, Dad loves me more than all of you bums. I mean, he's already spoke out in his family as the favorite son. So, you know, but he's a 17-year-old. He shouldn't have any tact. You know, he shouldn't have any sense at all at 17, and doesn't. But Jacob, who himself was the object of parental preference and spent 20 years up in Haran trying to deal with that, he ought to know a little better, shouldn't he? But he dresses this kid up in a garment that just distinguishes him from the rest of his brothers in a way that cannot possibly be missed. This ain't no shepherd's garment that he's made for him here. This is a robe of sorts that just flashes in their face every time they see this thing that he is the preferred son and they're not. A very colored tunic. A coat of many colors, kind of like a robe, four-length robe, full-sleeve type robe. Shepherds didn't dress like that. So anytime he's got this on, the shepherds in the family, which is all of them, and him are clearly distinguished from one another. Jacob is showing some really pathetic parenting in this situation. The whole idea of preferencing your children and bias against certain of your own children is just stupid. It's bad. And Jacob just follows right along. And his brothers see this thing in verse 4, and they hated him even more and could not speak to him on friendly terms. So between Joseph's lack of tact and Jacob's miserable parenting going on here, we have got a totally dysfunctional family where the brothers hate Joseph. And remember, there's a bunch of half-brothers in this deal. 6, 2, 2, and 2, in terms of their mothers. So you kind of have to work at finding a full brother in this family. And they don't like this guy. They don't like him at all. They couldn't even talk to him on friendly terms. And if it ain't bad enough, look what happens next. Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, which he probably tripped over himself trying to get to them to tell them this dream, they hated him even more. Now, if Joseph had any tact at all, he might have could have taken this dream and gone to dear old dad and said, "Hey, I had this dream, Dad. And here's what it was. And I kind of think maybe it means this, but would you mind kind of relating it to the family and perhaps showing a little bit of spiritual leadership here, just a tiny bit, and maybe they could tolerate it. They'd understand it. There'd be something beneficial here." Jacob ought to understand dreams, shouldn't he? Remember Jacob's ladder? And the other appearances of God in dreams? Jacob ought to know that God can speak to him and his family through dreams. But if he does, he doesn't manage it well at all. Maybe Joseph doesn't even give him a chance. I don't know. He runs to his brothers in verse 6 and says, "Hey, listen to this. Listen to this dream I've had. Here's the dream, guys. We were in the field binding sheaves, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf." How do you like that, guys? Isn't that a wonderful dream? While you're down there, would you mind buffing my shoes? A group of guys that already hate him, can't even talk to him civilly, and he goes and lays this on them. It's just a disaster. Nobody is showing any judgment. Nobody's showing any tact. Everything that's going on here is just stirring the pot. And it's a total mess. And the brothers, they get the picture here, okay, in verse 8. And they say to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more, if it was possible, for his dreams and for his words. They get the picture. Their sheaves bowing down to his sheaf. Ain't all that hard to figure out. It ain't rocket science. They get the picture and they understand that he's saying, in essence, they're going to bow down to him. So in addition to being in this position of biased privilege by his father relative to the other sons, he now lays that dream on them. Now, could Jacob not have set the family down and said, "Look, guys, the Lord has spoken to us as a family before through dreams. Maybe there's something in here of value for us. Let's think about this a little bit. Maybe God is going to use Joseph in some way that is superior to the rest of the boys. Let's think this through. Let's consider this for a while." But there's no spiritual leadership whatsoever from Jacob. He does nothing to mitigate the negative response of the brothers to this dream, because he doesn't show any spiritual judgment at all. Jacob is not finishing well in his life. And if that ain't bad enough, it gets worse. He has another dream in verse 9. And he ran as fast as he could to tell them that dream. He says, "Lo, I've had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." How many brothers are there? There's 11 besides him. And the sun and the moon, probably old mom and dad, huh? Mom and dad and the boys. And they're all bowing down to me. This guy's just constantly throwing gasoline on a smoldering fire, isn't he? And when he related it to his father's and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him. Now, why did he rebuke him? If it's a dream from God, why rebuke Joseph? You could say, well, because he had no tact and he ran off and told it to the brothers right away. Maybe that's why he's rebuking him. I don't know. But he's not helping any. And he said to him, "What is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come and bow down ourselves before you to the ground?" He understands the dream too. Jacob does. And this is exactly what's going to happen. But yet they're incredulous about it. They say, "Are you out of your mind, Joseph? You think we're going to come and bow down to you?" and his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now, if he keeps it in mind, if he thinks there's something about it that maybe is significant and has some value for the family, why not set everybody down and talk it through? See if you can't put it in proper perspective. It doesn't have to be pounding salt into an open wound here, but the way he manages it, it is. All right. So the scene is set. Joseph is the apple of father's eye. His 11 brothers can't stand him. 10 brothers. Benjamin's too young to care. But the other 10 brothers, they can't stand the guy. He has these visions that clearly shows himself in a superior position to them. And he's happy to relate that to them and pass it along right away. And so it just sets up for a situation where they don't like this guy. All right. That's the general setting. Now, verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Remember where that was? Remember that incident up there where Dinah got raped? That's up north there. I think my batteries are out. So they're up. Shechem is up about right there, across from Succoth. There's where he was for a while. And he comes over, and this map doesn't show it, but it's right about there. So they're living down here, but the flock is up here, about 50 miles or so away. So they've moved the flock up there. And Jacob wants to kind of get a report on how things are going. And remember, there was a little bit of a problem up there in that two of his sons murdered the entire city. And so he's maybe fearful that, well, we got the flock up there. Maybe somebody will kind of gather up some people and retaliate. So he wants to send Joseph up there to kind of check them out. Verse 13, Israel said to Joseph, are your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, and I'll send you to them. And he said, okay, I'll go. Kind of an obedient son anyway, it seems like. So he said to them, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So he goes up there on his own, about 50 miles away, to try to check in with the brothers and the flock and see how everything is doing. Annual inventory day, and he's got to go up there and get the inventory for Dad. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. What's the chances of that being a coincidence? That he just happens to find some guy up 50 miles away from home while he's out wandering in the fields looking for the flock and not able to find him. He finds some guy who happens to come along who asks him, what are you looking for? And he says, I'm looking for my brothers. Tell me where they are pasturing the flock. And a man said, they have moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. Now this guy that he just happens to run into just happens to have heard the brothers say where they're going to take the flock. What's the chance of that being random? There's no chance of that being random. Clearly, this is God at work here. He's brought the paths of this guy, whoever he is, across Joseph's path. He's happened to have heard the brothers say where they were going. And they've moved the flock up there, and so he tells them. And that's a little bit further north of where they were. They've come on up to about right, well, here's Dothan. It's actually on this map. See it right there? So they've come from here, Shechem, on up about another 13 miles or so to Dothan. So the flock is now up there. It's over 60 miles from home. But he just happens to hear it, and he just happens to run into Joseph, and so he can tell him where to go and to find his brothers. It's called divine providence, ladies and gentlemen. It's God taking care of business. And he crosses paths, he informs us, and so on, as we need to know things. And he is at work here in Joseph's life doing this. So he heads on up, verse 17. Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Verse 18, when they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. Now, these guys seem to understand one way to solve a problem in their lives, don't they? The problem at Shechem is solved by killing everybody. This problem with Joseph is solved by killing Joseph. The animosity between his brothers and him has gotten to the point now where they're willing to kill their own half-brother. And you remember what the Lord said in Matthew chapter 5 in the Olivet Discourse. He says, you've heard it say before that if you kill somebody, you're going to be held accountable and so on. He said, but I'm telling you that if you hate somebody enough to kill them, even if you don't pull the trigger, you're a murderer too. So these boys now have reached a point where they are actually murderers. They don't actually complete the task here, as we'll see, but they hate him enough that that's what they want to do. So they see him coming. Geez, I wonder how they knew it was him. Probably the blinding light from his coat is identifying him. They know it's him. They say, here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say, a wild beast devoured him. Well, what's a few lies to go along with a good murder, huh? No problem for them. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. You see the resentment level there? It's extremely high, isn't it? So much so that they're willing to kill the guy, lie about it to their father. I mean, this is a totally dysfunctional, almost spiritualist family. So that's the plan. Let's kill him and throw him in a pit. But Reuben, which son is he?
Number one.
Number one, right? Reuben's number one. Makes a great sandwich and makes a poor number one son. He heard this and he said, no. Let's don't do that. Let's not take his life. He probably senses maybe some sort of an obligation on behalf of his father. I don't know. Got a little bit of a conscience at work, it appears. So Reuben further said to him, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So Reuben's plan is to throw him into a pit, and he'll come back later and get him out of there and get him back down to his father. So Reuben's got a little bit of conscience, apparently, that the others don't have, and so he tries then to come up with plan B, which is don't kill him, let's just throw him in a pit. And when you guys are sleeping, I'll come back around and get him. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. Some kind of a cistern-like place, apparently. Tall, narrow, well-like thing that he couldn't climb out of. So they ripped that neon sign off of him and threw him in that pit. And remember, if it wasn't for Reuben, he'd be dead. And then they sat down to eat a meal. Nothing like pounding the daylights out of your half-brother to whet one's appetite, is it? These guys are very callous for young men. These guys are only like in their early 20s. Look how callous they are. They couldn't care about him in the least. And they're just going to sit down and eat a bite after wanting to kill him and just being stopped barely short of that by their older brother. So he's down in a hole in the ground, probably yelling at the top of his lungs for help. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. All right, well, he's down in the pit now. Here comes this, coincidentally, group of Ishmaelites, descendants of Ishmael, heading from Gilead down to Egypt. They got some goods and stuff they're going to sell down there. So they're on their way down there. And they just happened by at this moment when Joseph needed some help. And Judah speaks up now. Remember, he was one of Leah's six. A half-brother to Joseph. He's not a different mother. He speaks up and says, well, What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. Oh, wow. Now he really cares. And his brothers listen to him. So plan C is brought up by Judah. He says, well, let's make a buck off of this guy. Let's sell him to these Ishmaelites as a slave, and they can take him on down to Egypt with them on their way. They just happened to be going to Egypt to sell their stuff. They're not going north, not going back east. They're going down to Egypt to sell their stuff. Then some Midianite traders pass by. The Midianites and the Ishmaelites are essentially the same group of people here, same bunch. So they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph to Egypt. Sold him as a slave. The going rate at that time for a slave, a male slave, was 20 shekels of silver. So he got the price paid for him that Judas got for betraying the Lord, 20 pieces of silver. And they're on their way down to Egypt. Egypt isn't the promised land, is it? No, what the heck is going on here? Well, we'll see as the story unfolds that the nation Israel needed a sort of an incubator to grow into a nation. They're just, well, there's about 70 of them total as an extended family right now. We'll see that as when they head down there. But, you know, maybe 11 sons, a daughter and an infant son, or a young son, not an infant anymore, but a young son. Benjamin's the youngest one. So they're not what you call a massive military force or anything like that. So to become a nation that can occupy the promised land, they need to grow some, don't they? They need to propagate and to grow into something. And where is the best place to grow into a nation yourself than in the auspices of another nation, the mightiest nation on earth at that time? If you want to plant these people somewhere where they can grow in numbers and not be destroyed and annihilated by other peoples, put them in the umbrella of the greatest nation on earth and let them grow for another 230 years or so. That's what God is doing. He plants them in Egypt so they can grow into something that can take care of itself later. And so Egypt becomes an incubator for this nation. The Ishmaelites just happen to be going to Egypt. So that's what they do. That's how they get down to Egypt. That's how they grow into 2 million people, another 230 years or so from now, when God brings them out of there and heads them back for the promised land. Because the Ishmaelites were headed down to Egypt. And they just happened by at just the right time to sell Joseph to them. Does God control the affairs of men? He sure does. So Reuben comes sneaking back around later on to the pit to try to help Joseph out. And behold, Joseph wasn't there. There ain't no Joseph in the pit anymore. So he tears his garment. That's a gesture of mourning. Yikes, this is just terrible. He tears his garment. And he returns to his brothers and said, the boy's not there. As for me, where am I to go? What can I do? He ain't there. I got to go back and tell Dad that your favorite son, Joseph, is no longer? So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they brought the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Like there's more than one of those around in the world, right? Examine this thing real close here, Dad, and see if this is Joseph's coat. Because, you know, there could be like 100 of these out there. It's interesting that Jacob and Mom used a goat to deceive Isaac. Now Jacob's being deceived by the blood of a goat on his neon sign. So they set him up to think that Joseph's been killed by a wild animal. A bear ate him. And they don't have any more qualms about lying through their teeth to dear old dad than they did about possibly killing Joseph. And they refer to him, as you can see there in verse 32, as your sons. They don't ever refer to him as their brother. He's Jacob's son, not their brother. They don't have any association with him. So he examined it and he said, "This is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So he tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. These are heartless guys, aren't they? They see his father in this mournful state of misery. And that's okay. Their nemesis isn't around anymore. Neither is his coat. They got rid of both him and the coat. And they don't mind this form of deception and the price that Jacob has to pay for it at all. Then all of his sons and all of his daughters, I don't know who that is, quite frankly. The only daughter we have mentioned is Dinah. But the implication of this verse is that maybe he had more. I don't know.
Granddaughters.
Beg your pardon?
Could it be granddaughters, maybe?
That's possible, although these boys are, I don't know if they've got any, they may have some family at this point in time. And they do use that term interchangeably. Daughters can be granddaughters, sons can be grandsons. That's possible. Maybe that's the best explanation we're going to get because we don't have any names of anybody. But the whole family arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I'll go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. He's not going to be comforted over this apparent demise of his son. Now he doesn't know, of course, anything. He didn't know what we know. He can't pick his Bible up and read the rest of the story. So he thinks his son has been eaten by a critter and his favorite son is dead and gone. And he is in great mourning and nothing can comfort him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Now, of all the people down in Egypt that would pick up a slave for 20 pieces of silver, how is it he happens to be in this one particular household, the household of Potiphar, Pharaoh's bodyguard? This guy's just kind of a body away from Pharaoh at all times, isn't he? The Midianites just happen to be going down to Egypt. When he gets down there, they just happen to sell him to Potiphar, who has got the ear of Pharaoh himself, the leader of the greatest nation on earth. Man, these coincidences are just piling up here, aren't they? We know what God is doing here from knowing the rest of the story. But can you see how he's working out these details as though he actually has a plan? See how God controls the affairs of men? He's got Joseph right where he wants him. He's got Joseph right here. His owner is the bodyguard of Pharaoh, the leader of the greatest nation on earth. And remember, the plan is to tuck Israel in this Egyptian incubator for another 230 years so they can grow into a nation. So he's got him a seed planted down there in the household of, or real close to, the leader of Egypt, one Pharaoh. Isn't it fortunate that all of that stuff just happened to work out okay? As I say, it's a very, very clear illustration of that principle of divine providence and God working to control the affairs of men. And we'll see as the story unfolds how indeed he's using these pieces to bring about exactly what he wants to bring about. The comforting thing about all of this is Joseph's life any different than yours, in principle at least? Can God not control the affairs of your life to put you right where he wants you, to have your paths crossed with the people he wants them to cross with, to influence things and bring about things in your life? Does God's superintending care apply only to this dysfunctional, pathetic family? No, of course not. He can take care of us just as thoroughly and as completely as he did Joseph, and he does. It's okay in life to be perplexed. Paul says, at times I was perplexed, but I wasn't despairing. I didn't understand what was going on at times, he says, but I never despaired over it because I knew who was in charge. I knew who was in control of my life. So it's okay to be confused, but you never have to despair as a child of God. Joseph, I'm sure, was very confused. He might even been trying to despair a little bit too, but he'll learn some things as he goes along here. But it is a truth for us as believers that God is in control of our lives. If you are confused, perplexed, go ask for help and insight. But you never have to despair because you are in God's hands. He's the original, insurance company in good hands, Allstate, yeah. Original Allstate agent. You're in good hands with God. And Joseph is in God's hands. He doesn't know it quite so well yet. He'll learn it more as we go along. He later understands it very, very clearly. He'll tell the brothers about it too later on. But our lives are in God's hands just as Joseph's were. So it's a very good story, a very good illustration of that principle. Every now and then we need to reread it, maybe remind ourselves of the fact that, man, I don't know what's going on in life here. This is kind of getting a little bit scary. It's getting a little bit unpredictable. Maybe God's lost track of me. Maybe he doesn't know where I'm at. He always knows where you're at. Read Psalm 139 along with this if you have any problems believing that God knows where you're at. Anyway, a good lesson for us, one that we can remind ourselves of from time to time to remind ourselves of the superintending care of our lives by God. Any questions or comments about anything we saw here this morning? Chapter 36, which I don't know much about. Chapter 37 is this very familiar story of how the nation is going to get into Egypt so that they can grow into a self-sustaining nation. And we see the seedlings of that, how that came about here with Joseph. Joseph's going to be the guy. Questions or comments about anything? Yeah, Betty?
Do they have free-range rights to just take their flocks anywhere they want to?
Well, apparently Betty's question is, how come these guys can just move their flocks anywhere they want to? Apparently the land is not really established real well and populated real heavily, and so I think the answer is, at this point in time, yes. You just kind of go wherever you got enough strength to hold the ground and to move your flocks and so on. Now remember, Shechem was a city up there before, but it ain't anymore because they killed all of them. So it's kind of a void area, and maybe their pasture land was good and he figured, well, I'll take them up there, and did. But it is a little unusual that they're like 60 miles away from home with all those flocks in it. You'd think they'd be a little closer than that, but I guess you take them wherever you need to keep them watered and fed. And at this point in time, there's not enough people around to do anything about it. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Jerry?
Do they have to Is it possible that the handmaidens would have been Egyptian servants? I mean, would they have used people of their own breeding for Dan's mother and that group, like Hagar was Egyptian?
Well, no, remember that. Well, we don't necessarily know their origin, but they were up there in Mesopotamia. You would guess they would be maybe Mesopotamians, since they came out of Laban's household. But we don't know with certainty. It's possible, I suppose, that they could have been of Egyptian origin. You'd wonder, how in the world did they get up there? But I would think they were probably just other Mesopotamian ladies. They would be Iraqis today, if they were on the earth today, in that area. But
not particularly Gentiles. We don't know. Would they have been Gentiles, considered Gentiles?
Well, they would have been Semites, I think. They would have been from the Shem's descendants up there, because the whole family was, and so probably they would be Shemites or Shem's descendants. So probably the term Gentile might not quite apply just yet. That distinction will arise as time goes on more clearly. But don't know for certain who these handmaids, what their genealogy and what their origin might be. The girls, of course, were both Shemites. We know Laban's daughters, Leah and Rachel. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Cheryl.
I'm not familiar when the scapegoat was used before.
Say again now.
I'm not sure about the scapegoat. When were you saying a goat was used before to deceive?
Yeah, remember he cooked this meal. Cheryl's questioning the similarity of the goats being used in some of these stories. Remember, Jacob and his mother deceived his father by cooking a goat to taste like deer. So, okay. A goat was involved there, and a goat is going to be involved next week also. Goats are all over the place in these stories. They're important players, the goats are. Are you familiar with the expression, Moses' goat, or as guilty as Moses' goat? There's a scapegoat in Scripture that the sins of the nation on the Day of Atonement were actually placed on this goat figuratively by the hands of the high priest. One goat was sacrificed, the other goat was led out into the wilderness, and in essence, the sins are being sent away. Like the concept of forgiveness is sending our sins away. That goat is called a scapegoat, and he's the one that survives of the two and is ran off into the wilderness with the sins of the nation on him, figuratively speaking. So goats play a prominent role in Israel's history. And we'll see one next week, too. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. Any other questions or comments? All right, we'll let you roll. You owe me 5 more minutes.